Thank the Rosh Yeshiva and the Rabbonim and the Talmidim for allowing me to speak. To be honest, if I wouldn't have been invited, I would have asked for an opportunity to come and speak to you. And not because I'm so eager to do public speaking, that's not my area, but it's a question of responsibility. And I feel responsible to relay a certain message that was relayed to me. And I feel that message is important. I'm not quite sure that this is the type of talk that is typical of giving to a yeshiva situation, which I happen to encounter right now. But I will proceed. And the reason that I feel responsible is as follows. My mother was taken to Auschwitz when she was about 16, 17 years old. She came from a Hasidic family in Hungary. When the Germans entered Hungary, the first thing they did, one of the first thing in their town, they took the men, they sent them to work camps, and they took the rest of the family to Auschwitz. They came to their house just before Shabbos came in. It was Friday. It was an atmosphere, a pre-Shabbos atmosphere. They knocked on the door, barged in, took the family, told them they have 5 minutes to pack their belongings and start the march towards Auschwitz. Can you imagine? Friday, the smell of Shabbos. Within 5 minutes, you're out there, start marching towards Auschwitz. They took him to cattle train, and they sent the family to Auschwitz. And when they arrived at Auschwitz, what occurred over there was as follows. The trains came. They were unloaded. The people were unloaded from the cattle tracks. They stood in line, and Dr. Mengele, the Nazi doctor, Satan, he was the first one that they were introduced to. And his job was to make the selection, left and right. Left means death, directly to the gas chambers. Right means life. Life under those conditions were maybe 2 or 3 months of survival, but it meant life. Now the family approached, my mother's family approaches him. She's about 16, 17 years old. The rest, 8 brothers and sisters, younger than her. And the family is approaching him, and he's approaching them. And he's standing there and making left and right. Right, as I said, life, left to the death. And he comes and he sees the family. He sees my mother. She doesn't have a Jewish appearance. She's blonde. She doesn't look too Jewish under those circumstances, apparently. And he told her to go to the right. He said, you must be probably the maid of the family. You're probably the goy. You go over there. The rest to the left, 8 brothers and sisters, younger than her, mother, grandmother, and grandfather, to the left, to the guest chambers. And they started to part. My mother was trying to fight going back to the left. She didn't know what it means, right or left. At that time, they didn't know what it meant. She wanted to go to family. And he forced her to go to the right. He said, you're not a Jew. You stay there. The rest of you to the left. Her mother told her not to force herself to go to the left because the mother realized what it meant going to the left. And she did not. And as they parted, and the two lines parted from each other, and as the family, the 8 children, the grandparents, and the mother approached, came closer and closer to the gas chamber. And when she's beginning to lose sight of her daughter, my mother, she yelled out and she said to her, Judith, that was her name, don't forget that you're a Jewish girl. And that's the last thing she heard. And that's it. It was finished. That was the end. That's the last thing she heard from her mother. And that's what a Jewish mother, if that's what a Jewish mother could tell her daughter at the last point of her life, just before she goes to her death, when she parts from her daughter, if that's the last thing she could say, that means something. That means responsibility. That means a message that has to go from generation to generation. Don't forget that you're a Jewish girl. And that's what she said to her. And that's what my mother told me. And that's why I'm here, to tell you what it means. Don't forget that you're a Jewish girl or a Jewish boy. It doesn't make a difference. And the story is as follows. And I will tell you my story, which means the same thing. But before I proceed, about a month ago, a new ambassador was appointed to Israel from Great Britain. And he's a Jewish ambassador. And when he was appointed, he asked the foreign ministry of Israel if they could have a meeting for him. He would like to meet various parts of the Jewish-Israeli population, the Hasidish, the Litvak, the Sephardim, the Chiloinim, whatever. And he wants to learn about the Jewish community and so on in Israel. And he wants to ask a few questions. And we got together in this house, and it was a non-political meeting. Just people from various sectors of the Israeli community. And he said, look, I want to do my job with sincerity. I want to be successful. And I want to understand something about you Jewish people. And we asked him what he wants to understand. He said, I'll ask you a question, and I want a sincere answer. How come such a small nation, surrounded by so many enemies, has so many sectors, so many types of Jews, quarrel all the time? Why do you always quarrel? And we haven't seen that in any parts of the world. What's going on? So many directions, so many ideas, so many thoughts. What's going on? And he asked them. And I represented the Baal Tshuva movement. I don't know if you know, I had Arachim, the Tshuva organization, international. And he asked me, what is your answer? And I wasn't prepared for the question, but I felt that the answer is as follows. That's what I felt. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm right. I said to him, listen, as far as you're concerned, we're one united people. The issue is an issue of survival. We want to survive. We've been busy with survival for thousands of years. And we just want to survive. And that's the issue. Some people think survival should be done this way, or that way, or this way. And the whole quarrel is, how do we survive? But as far as you're concerned, we're one people. That's it. And that's the issue. And that's what I'm here to talk to you about. Because that's what my mother said, was told by her mother. Survive. Survive as a Jewish girl. And that means survival, to survive Jewish. My father came to the camps also from a Hasidic family from Poland. He went through the camps as follows. When the Germans came into this town, they set up a ghetto right away. They had an SS or Gestapo police station they set up. And one of the first things they did, they had to gather 1,000 Jews, get them out of the ghetto, and send them to some kind of a location where nobody comes back from. My father hid on top of the German Nazi police station on the roof as they were grabbing people off the street. They needed 1,000 Jews, men, to take them out of the ghetto. Nobody would look for a Jew on top of the German SS police station. So he was hiding there, hiding on the roof, watching the whole scenario of how they catch Jews and grab them and send them out. At the end of the line, he saw a Jew who was torn away from his family, wife and children. And the family was crying. And my father realized they have no chance of survival if he leaves his family. And he was a young man, 19-year-old. He jumped off the roof, ran over to the end of the line, switched with him, was punished very severely for doing so. But the Germans, as you know, are very precise. They need the 1,000 Jews. They took the 1,000 Jews out of the ghetto. My father was one of them. In a way, he saved that specific Jewish man. What happened to him later on, nobody knows. That's how he got into the camps. Eventually, my father was freed. My mother was freed. And they got married in Europe. I was born in Israel and grew up, unfortunately, secular in Ramat Gan, town near Tel Aviv. At the age of 12, my parents immigrated to America, New York, Bronx. We weren't too well off, and I grew up in a poor neighborhood in the Bronx, arrived there at 12 years old, and my first day in junior high school, public school. Most of the kids were not Jewish, Italian, Irish, Puerto Ricans, Negroes, whatever you want. And I go into the class, first day, the Jewish boy walks into a class from Israel, he comes. And my teacher says to the children, here's, we have a new boy in the class, we'll have to help him out, he doesn't speak English, and so on and so on. And first recess, I go to the schoolyard, and there's my first welcome. About 6-7 kids walk over to me, stand in front of me, raise their hand and say, Hi Hitler. That was my welcome to junior high school in the Bronx, New York. Wasn't too easy. I grew up helping Panose, sell the New York Post in the streets, worked in wedding halls at night, clean up, busboy, dishwasher, whatever, just to help in Panose. At age 18, 19, Vietnam War broke out. Was a mass draft, and I was drafted also by the U.S. Army, but we had a choice to go to either the Marines, Navy, or Air Force. That was volunteer. We had a better chances of promoting ourselves there, so I decided to volunteer to the Marines. We had to go to special training. I asked to go into a helicopter training, which means air crew, either pilots or whatever, but it's air crew. At that time, I realized as soon as I got involved in this, the chances of survival are very low. It was the beginning of the war. About 80% of those who went through this course came back in caskets. And I got cold feet, worked myself out of the program, and at that time they needed engineers, electrical and electronic engineers, and I was got a deferment to study in the university engineering, and at the end of that study, I would have to work for a defense industry. That was part of the agreement, the contract. Meanwhile, I got married. And here I am in New York, finished college, got my engineering degree, and I work into this company which hired me, defense contracts they had with the U.S. government. I walk in, I was accepted to this company. The reason I was accepted to this company was because they thought I was not Jewish. Why? Because my name is Joseph C. Wallace in English. And they were looking for engineers who were not Jewish, because they had contracts with Arabian countries like Saudi Arabia and so on. They had a policy of not hiring Jews. It was sort of a secret policy. And here I am, a young engineer, started working in a company, and I noticed there were no Jews. And not only there were no Jews, they were very anti-Semitic. There were jokes about Jews here and there. And my immediate boss was a German. There were many other Germans in the company. Not only was he German, he was an ex-Nazi. And he didn't hide that fact. At that time, the Americans needed engineers. They overlooked their past history. They allowed them to come into America. They hired them as an engineer. And he was my immediate boss. His name was Eckhart. And this Mr. Eckhart tells me more or less as we work together about his past history. And at a certain stage, they asked the young engineers who just walked into the company to present themselves to the rest of the employees of the company. And we had like a meeting together in one afternoon with coffees and cake and so on. And each one of us young engineers had to stand up and present themselves to the rest so they'll be acquainted with each other. And my turn came up. And I said, okay, I'm going to tell them exactly what I think about them now. All along, they think I'm not Jewish. So I get up and I said, hello, my name is Joseph C. Wallace. But really, my name is Chaim Yosef Wallace. And my parents are Auschwitz graduates. And I know you hired me because you thought I wasn't Jewish. Well, I want you to know that I'm a proud Jew. And then I told them a little bit about their background. And I don't want to tell you what I said about them. And I said, at this point, I quit my job, and I walked out. I go home to my wife. I just got married not a while ago. And I tell her, listen, I don't feel this is a place for me. We're going to Israel. And we went to Israel. Here I am, a young man in Israel. Get drafted to Israeli Army, joined the Air Force, served in the Air Force during the War of Attrition, Yom Kippur War in the Air Force, finished the Army as a captain, and now I need Parnassah also, we moved to Los Angeles here. Opened up the business here, started a business in helicopter business, parts for helicopters, manufacturing parts for military type helicopters. Things were very well. Eventually had branches and agents worldwide, and did a wonderful business. After 4 years or so, I decided to go back to Israel, continue the same business in Israel. And here I am, have a business in Tel Aviv. I live in Ra'anana, which is a suburb of Tel Aviv. Nice house, nice wife, nice kids, everything perfect. Let things just stay the way it is. But apparently Hashem doesn't think the same way as I, and he made the change. And the following change took place. One day my wife calls me and she says, Yossi, I didn't cook today. Could you bring home some takeout food? I said, why not? On my way home to the house after work, about 5 p.m., I drive by one of these takeout restaurants on the way from Tel Aviv to Ra'anana, which is a suburb of Tel Aviv. And I stop by to buy takeout food. And this restaurant happens to sell what we call in Israel steak, white steak in pita bread. White steak in pita bread means that the type of meat that they put in there is dvar acher. And that's the meat they sell. And you understand, I was secular. And as I stand in line to buy this for my family, I recall the following story. As a kid, I used to ask my parents, how come I don't have a grandfather? How come I don't have a grandmother? How come I don't have aunts and uncles? And they told me how they all perished in the Holocaust. And then as I stand in line, I recall the story of my mother's father, that same mother I told you that her mother told her, don't forget it, you're a Jewish girl. What happened to the father, her father? Her father was taken to a war camp. When they were taken to Auschwitz, he was taken to a different camp just prior to that. And when he went to that different camp, he suffered a lot over there. It was a concentration camp. The end of the war. The Germans retreat. They leave the camp. They lost the war. The Russians are marching in to conquer the camp. And the camp commander, the Nazi, at the end of the war, just his last minutes of camp, listen to what he does. He gathers the surviving Jews. He puts them in a circle. He gets in the center of the circle. He selects my grandfather because he was a tzaddik. He tried to keep Jewish laws as much as he could under these circumstances. And they knew it. So he selects him. He pulls him into the center of the circle. He takes a piece of pork meat, puts it in front of his face. Takes a gun and puts it against his head. And he makes the following speech to the surviving Jews. And he tells them as follows. That's your last day. Your suffering is over. All of you are going home. You're going to see your family and kids. The war is finished. We lost. We are retreating. But before we free you, we want to check your rabbi. He's pointing to my grandfather. And he says, Rabbi, if you eat this, you'll go home just like everybody else. You see your family, kids, it's all over. But if you don't eat this, you'll be the last to die in camp. And he takes the gun and points it to his head. Make your decision. And then he turns to the Jews and he tells them, let's see what he decides to do now. Let's see him now make a decision. And he stands there. He looks him in the face. My grandfather looks at the face of the Nazi commander. And he says, I won't eat this. And he shot him and he died. That's how my grandfather died. His grandson stands in line amongst other Jews and Eretz Israel, buying for his family out of his own free choice. He could eat anything he wants. Paying out of his own pocket. The same thing that my grandfather died for. Standing in line, I said to myself, either my grandfather was out of his mind or I'm out of my mind. And I refuse to believe that my grandfather was out of his mind. I refuse. Therefore, I'm out of my mind. And I walked out of the line. And I came home to my wife. And I said, how is this possible? How is it possible for me to do such a thing? Just one generation away. Could you give me an answer? Could you give me an answer? How come I can do this thing when my grandfather did that? And she says, I have no answer. I says, so who can give me an answer? At that time, I had no relationship with the Rabbanim. I had no relationship with the Jewish Orthodox community or religious community, to say the least. So who's going to give me an answer? I got to understand. So all that beautiful life I had at that point, everything is going all so well. All of a sudden, this thought came to my mind as I stand in line to buy this for my family. Why? I don't know. I knew it all the time. But that's when it came to my mind. And I had no answer. And I said, I got to find an answer. And then listen to what happens. A new idea came up in Israel at that time. Let's have a seminar. A seminar means we'll bring non-from Jews, secular Jews together with Rabbonim. And we'll bring them for a long weekend. And we'll let them have discussion groups. And they'll listen to lectures. And maybe they'll change their approach and direction of life. Maybe they'll become Shomrei Torah and Mitzvot. That was the idea. Usually these arguments between the religious and non-religious end up with nothing. But that's a situation. We have, you know, a few days together. And I decide to go to one of those test case seminars, the first seminar. Take my wife, my three kids, and we drive to the seminar. As we arrive, I want to park the car. And I see this Rav walk with a box. And I ask, hey, Kvod Rav, Mr. Rabbi, where should I park my car? I want to come to that seminar. I understand it's somewhere here. And he puts the box on the hood of my car. And as I sit there, I look in the box. And as he's explained to me, I see that in the box they have these kippot. And I ask him, what is that for? And he said, that's for people who want to put on their head while they're in the seminar. I said, forget it. That's not for me. I didn't come here to become a Baal Tshuva. I came here to listen, to learn about my grandfather. So I said, don't worry, we don't force you. I'm just telling you to understand how I started. So we go to the seminar. We listen to lectures here and there. They talk to your heart. They talk to your logic. All various. I'm not here to tell you what we heard and what happened there. But one thing I did realize. They gave us an example of a study. How do you study Gemara? First time they showed us a Gemara. The participants of the seminar said, okay, what's Gemara all about? Let's show you. We had a lecture about the oral law. And we said, okay, now we'll show you what the Gemara is all about. So we look, first time I see Gemara in my life. The person who was teaching it happened to study at that time, Masechet Sukkah, the Sugya of Lulav HaGazul. And we look at it, but I noticed something very interesting, something that I never saw in my life. The whole idea of learning is questioning. In other words, you encourage the learner, the Talmid, to ask questions. And I ask me questions, ask me. And whoever asks a better question is a more Talmid Chochem. Whoever gives him the answer is more than him. And you then have a counter question, and questions a question. Everything has got to match all the other sugyas in the Gemara. It sounded very interesting, very strange. What I learned in college, that if you ask questions in Christianity or in Muslim, you are a hypocrite. You either get your head chopped off at a certain stage or they put you to the stake. So how come we encourage asking questions? But I notice one thing. When it comes to Sukkot, and we study this thing about Lulav, and maybe yes, maybe no, but this plant, this tree or that tree, this fruit or that fruit, and I don't have to tell you what the sugya is all about. But when it comes to Sukkot, and after those thousands of years of learning, everybody takes a Lulav and they walk and they may not a Lulav. And I'm going to find a million-dollar question which will maybe contradict this whole idea of Lulav? No way, I got no chance. And if that's true about this mitzvah, it's true about every mitzvah. So I'm going to take it on, and I'm going to become firm, because that means they've got the truth. If somebody's not afraid of being questioned, that means he's got the truth. And that was what broke me, what made me change my mind. And that was the decision I made, and became a Baal Tshuva. But one thing I want you to know, I was afraid. I was afraid to make a change. So my heart was in there, my logic was there, I had sought a vote to make a change, but there was one problem. I was afraid to do it myself. So I grabbed one of the participants at the seminar. I was a contractor who came to the seminar just like me. And I said, Mr. Feig, his name was Feig. I said, Mr. Feig, I need a friend. He says, what do you mean? He says, I want to make a change. I'm going to come about Shuva. What about you? He says, I'm afraid. I says, okay, you're afraid. I'm afraid. Let's make a deal. He says, what's the deal? I'll tell you what the deal is. You and I are going to make a contract. Then I'm going to keep the mitzvot as part of the contract to you. I'm obliged to you. And you're obliged to keep the mitzvot to me. And that's the contract. And we're going to shake hands on that. In other words, if you don't keep the mitzvot, you haven't kept your word with me. And me against you. Leave the Rabbeinu Shalom out at this stage. We shook hands and we made a deal. That was like a psychological trick. Because I knew I need some kind of a supervision here. So I found a supervisor. I made a deal. Which businessman doesn't like to keep his word? Shook hands on it. That was the idea. I had a partner now. And I'm obliged to keep the mitzvot. And every day he checked on me. And I checked on him. And I want to keep my contract. But I'll tell you what the problem was. In all this whole process, I forgot one thing. To consult my wife. It's my partner. We have children together. Didn't consult my wife. On our way home now, she sits next to me, three kids in the back seat, and we drive home. And now I've got that same kippah that was in the box. Now it's on my head. And she says to me, Yossi, you forgot the kippah on your head. We're going home now. You don't need the kippah now. This is 7 hours old. And I said, I didn't forget. I said, so how come it's on your head? I said, because I want it on my head. She says, what do you mean? I said, because right now I became dati. She says, what do you mean? And we started a whole conversation. She got scared, and she didn't want to go along in the beginning. She was afraid. I could understand. And she said, what are we going to do now? I said, no, we're driving to my parents. My parents lived in Israel at that time. They lived in Tel Aviv. I don't have tefillin. That was Motzei Shabbos. Sunday morning, I need tefillin. So we go to my father to pick up tefillin. My tefillin for my bar mitzvah was still over at my parents' home. So he drives. He says, okay, I'm going to talk to your father. I was very close to my father. I'm going to have him talk you out of it. You're too extreme. So we all walk into my parents' home, Motzei Shabbos night. I walk in with a smile from ear to ear. My wife walks in. It's like she had a sad face, a Tisha B'Av face, we call it. We both walk in. My father looks, my mother looks, says, what's going on over here? So I tell my father, listen, I made a change. And my wife tells him, please talk him out of it. And he says, it'll wear off. He just got excited. I said, no, Dad, I didn't get excited. That's serious. Where's my tefillin? So he walks over to the attic, takes out my old suitcase where I left my stuff from before I got married, and he sees my tefillin and brings over that tefillin. And as he hands over the tefillin, he starts crying. My father's not the type of guy to cry. What are you crying, Dad? What's going on? So he says, listen, you put me on a spot. She wants to have me talk you out of it, and you want to take a step. And your grandfather, my father, who you named after, was a tzaddik. Was a melamed in a cheder. And you, it looks like you're going to become a tzaddik also, and I'm going to be right in the middle. I've got a problem here. So I said, so what's the problem? He says, I'll tell you what the problem is, and he tells me the following story. Dachau concentration camp, Germany, during World War II. My father's in the camp. Terrible camp, death camp. He's in that camp. He weighed a few pounds, I don't know how many. He had striped clothes. A group of Jews walk into the camp. They're brought into the camp, taken right to their death. They were all Jews. They had no chance of survival. They just go kill them. One of the Jews has a small bag in his hand. He throws it to my father. My father grabs it. He thinks maybe there's a piece of bread inside. And he opens up the bag, and what does he see? He sees tefillin. At that time, if anybody had tefillin, they kept met death. Nobody could allow something like that. So he put it under his shirt, and at nighttime, when they put him back in the barracks, he put it under the straw. They slept on straw. And early in the morning, before they took him out to the count, they would take him out to the count and count them every morning, he decides to put that tefillin on. And as he puts that tefillin on, one of the Germans opens up the door to the barrack and he sees my father at the end of the barrack in the corner with tefillin. He cried out a yell and he said to the Germans, come in, we caught a Jew. We caught a Jew doing something terrible. They grabbed him. They took his number. They had the numbers on their arm. They had no names. He said, okay, we're going to show you what we're going to do with you this morning. And as they go out to the appel, that's when they count them. That's what they call them. There was the women's camp right next by. They had the barbed wire between the camps. They brought the women to watch the hanging ritual of my father. They call out his numbers. They stand out there. They had no names, just numbers. They call out his number. And a German officer there, the Nazi officer in charge, he takes that feeling and he waves it to everybody. And he says, you see this? We caught him with this feeling, with these boxes. And you're going to see what we're going to do to him. There was a table there. There was a bar over the table. There was a hanging rope there. He says, get on the table. He gets on the table. They put the rope around his neck. And then the idea is they pull the table under his feet. He's supposed to fall down and hang. He says, get on the table. They put the rope around the neck. And the German is waving the tefillin. And jokingly, just before they pull the table under his feet and hanging him, he asks the Jew, and he says, "Hey, dog, what's your last wish before you die?" As though they cared what the last wish of a Jew is. He says, "What's your last wish?" He says, "I want to put them on again." And the German says, "Wow, from the bar, great idea. You put them on, and we'll hang you with a tefillin on. And we're going to keep you hanging there till tomorrow morning. So everybody could see that you hanged with them on and they'll understand why you hang. A great idea. Put them on." Standing on a table, rope still around his neck, he puts on the tefillin. And he's still saying the brachas. V'arastich le'am. V'arastich lech b'tzedek mishpat b'chesed b'racham. And he stands there. And now they put the table on his feet. He's supposed to fall and die. And he's watching. And he sees the Jews watching him. And the Germans are standing around. And the dogs are around. And the ladies from the women's camp are watching. And nobody says a word. Complete silence. Even the dogs are barking. And he says, tears. The Jews have tears in their eyes. And he said to me, "You have to understand, at that stage of the game, nobody had tears in his eyes. Our eyes were dried up. We had no tears. We had so much sorrow and so much suffering already that we had no more tears. Our eyes were dried up. And I see tears. Very strange. And I understand that they feel sorry for me. They pity me because I'm going to die now. And you know what I felt like? I felt like a victor, not like a victim. I felt like a Rick Victor. You know what it means to stand on top of the table and everybody's watching you, even the Germans, the dogs, and everybody's watching you with the feeling on your last moment in your life? And that's how you're going to end up, your life? I felt like a victor. I don't understand why they're crying. So I yelled out my last cry before they pulled the table under my feet. And I yelled out and I said, "Jews, why are you crying? Don't you understand that I'm the winner here?" That's why I cried out. And the Germans also realized that they made a terrible mistake. He's a winner. And they all agree with him. What a mistake. Everything upside down. So they made a change. They said, "No way. We're going to show you how to die. Get off the table." And they take the rope off his neck. Fill it off his body. And he gets off the table. They say, "We're going to show you how to die. You're not going to be the winner here." They give two heavy rocks. "Go to a squat position. We're going to beat you in your head 25 counts. Then a whip. The whip was from a tail of a bull. Very tough whip. We're going to hit you 25 times in your head. You can drop rocks at any minute. And when you drop rocks, you'll be shot to death. You can make your decision. You can drop them anytime you want to. You have no chance of survival anyway. Nobody can withstand those number of whips. So you just drop them." They wanted him to choose his own death. They wanted him to decide when to die. And he said, "No, I won't give you the pleasure. I want to allow you for me to die 1 minute before I'm supposed to die. I'm not going to drop any of these rocks." And he gets down to a squat position. He understands he has no chance. And they start beating him. They start to count. One, two, and he gets beating, and he gets beating. He's already blood in his face. "I'm not going to drop the rocks. They won't have that pleasure." And he didn't drop the rocks. He withstood the whole 25 counts. And when they finished, he just fainted. But they didn't shoot him because that was the agreement. But he fainted, and they thought he was dead. So they threw him on a pile of dead people. And the idea was that they would shove those dead people into a pit and put some kerosene in them and burn them. That was the idea. But he came back to himself, and he realized that they should get out of that pile right away. And he crawled out of the pile. And so a Jew passed by and threw a rag on his head. That's how he somehow survived. He was hiding under one of the barracks. He finally survived. In the women camp, there was a woman. There was a child, a teenager, 17-year-old. My mother, she was there. That's how she met my father. First time she saw him with a rope on his head. She saw the whole thing. And then when they were freed by the Americans, when they came and conquered that area, and she had nobody in the world, and he had nobody in the world, she just walked over to him. And she said, "I got nobody in the world. You don't only want to know. Would you marry me?" And he married her. That's how I came. So he's handing me now that tefillin. And he says, "You understand now why I'm crying?" He says, "You really believe I can talk you out of this?" And he goes, tomorrow, if you really believe that I can talk him out of this, no way. And not only am I not going to talk him out of this, I'm going to join him. And I'm going to be a Baal Teshuva with my son together. And that's right on that spot, he became a Baal Teshuva. And the two of us progressed together step by step. I had my friend at the company. I wasn't alone anymore. My father went along with me, and he didn't break the link. And here I am, a new Baal Teshuva with my father, very happy. Eventually, my wife joined me, my mother joined me, my mother-in-law joined me, my father-in-law joined me. Everybody, the whole family became Baal Teshuva, all because of that one grandfather who stood over there. But I want you to know one thing. I was very upset, on the other hand. You know why I was upset? Because I was misinformed about Judaism. I was misinformed about our Jewish heritage. I was misinformed. I would misjudge our ancestors. Because you know what they taught us? They taught us that these Jews, the Holocaust Jews, maybe other Jews prior to that period or era, went to their death like sheep. That's how they went to the dead. They were cowards. They were gutless Jews. That's what they taught us. We are a new generation. We are different generations. That's what they taught us. And me, who served in the armies and so on, I'm the hero. They are the real heroes. And when I asked my father, tell me that, why did you survive this thing? You didn't know when this war is going to end. You just saw death all the time. You didn't know where to go. You couldn't go back to your home after what you're going through. Where would you go back to? You didn't know what's going to end. You don't know what's going to happen. 6 million Jews are dying. It's like wiping out the whole country of Israel. So why did you survive? How did you survive? You know what he told me? I used to Ribono Shel Olam one thing every day. I repeated that request. And I said, Hashem, let me just finish this one day. No more, just one day. I just want to live today. And I feel I got the right to ask for it. He says, what was the right to ask for it? I said, do you remember the beginning of the war when I switched with another Jew? I know exactly the risk I'm taking. I switched with another Jew. I gave my life for another Jew. You won't give me one day? And I repeated that request every day for 5.5 years. And he listened to me. And that's how I survived. And when I was born, you know what my father tells me? When my son was born, my first son, I called up my father and I said, Dad, I got a son, his first grandson. Call up my father. And he says to me, you know, see, you should be thankful you got somebody to call and tell him you got a son. I said, that's what you got to tell me? Say Mazel Tov, you know, what is this? You got to be thankful to have somebody to call. What is this? And he says, I'll tell you, when you were born, and I was just a survivor of the camps. And I came to Israel. And I was an outlaw because I came in illegally. And I was hiding next to the hospital where my mother was supposed to give birth. It was an orange grove. I was hiding that night so that someone would relay a message to me what came of this birth, my son or my daughter, whatever. And then as I was hiding there at night, somebody who knew where I was hiding walked over to me and he said, listen, you got a son. And you know what I felt like? I wanted to call my father and tell him I got a son. After this whole ordeal, I finally got a son. I'm alive. Life is continuing. And I didn't have a father. And I wanted to call my mother. I didn't have a mother. She was killed in one of the camps. And I wanted to call my father-in-law, or my mother-in-law. They're all killed. My brothers, my sisters. Nobody called. You should be thankful you got somebody to call and tell them you have a son. Did you ever think of it? You have that Akarat HaTov? That's what he said to me, son. So now you're going to tell me that that's why I was upset. Somebody's going to tell me that they were cowards. They're not the real heroes. They're not the real brave Jews. They're not the one that because of them we exist and we're here. And you don't have to be me to realize that. Everybody in this room, every Jew had such ancestors. I just happened to have it one generation away. Or I just happened to know one generation away. Who knows what they went through? What Kiddush Hashem? What was going in the past history? We just maybe we don't know it directly. So they're going to tell me that my grandfather who stood over there, he said, I won't eat it. He was a coward. You're going to tell me that my father stood out there and he said, I'm the winner. Tell me what Jew, what person from what nation could ever say when you're in the camps, under siege, under such circumstance, feel like a victor? Just us Jews. We are the only ones who can say that under such circumstance, we are the winners. And you're going to tell me that we are the heroes and they are the cowards? Just the opposite. That's why I was upset. But all in all, I was grateful. And apparently, thank Hashem and my grandfather for going through what we went through and see the whole family, Shomai Torah Mitzvot. But I just want to tell you just a few things. I wanted you to know, the hardest part in making tshuva, the hardest part, is nothing to make change in your life, and all of a sudden you're going to keep mitzvahs, and you're going to daven and go this and that. That's easy, that's nice. That's not a problem. You know what the hardest part is? Ben Adam Lechaveo. When I went through the process, and they said, Yossi, everything is nice. You and Hashem can get along great. What are you going to do about your friends? You wronged some people that you had business deals with. You may have wronged some friends. You may have wronged some people. Maybe you took something away that doesn't belong to you. You've got to take everything back. This you can pray to, you blue in your face. That won't help. So you make a list. This I did this, this I did that, and got to correct everything. And a checklist. That's the most difficult part. I want you to think about that. That's the difficult part. And I want to tell you something a little funny. To become a Baal Tshuva is a little funny. And I'll tell you what I mean now when you're looking back. First Shabbos. I'm going to keep Shabbos now. First Shabbos in my life, okay? I go to shul. I decide to go there a little early. Davening starts on Shabbos at 8 o'clock. I'm going to come there at 7:45. And I'm going to take the last row. And that's why I came early, so I can grab the last seat in the row. So because I don't know how to daven, I don't know when to stand, sit, go left, go right, whatever it takes, I'm going to take last row. Nobody can see me. I feel comfortable, and that's it. I'm going to sit in the other seat. I was ashamed. I come in early before everybody cuts into shul, take the last seat, wait. People walk in. Eventually, the shul gets full. All of a sudden, this person walks over to me, taps me on the back, and he says, Mister, you're sitting in my seat. I said, okay, so let me be. He says, no, that's my regular seat. I got a seat. You'll find another seat. That's my regular seat. So I said, do me a favor. Just let me stay there. He says, no. That's my seat. I'll take you somewhere else. You know where he takes me? He turns right to the front, to the mizrach. He says, I'll put you over here. You're a guest. I said, not that. He says, no, you got to put you over there. And he puts me in the front. And I was a little embarrassed because I really didn't know how to handle myself. But I'll tell you what the worst part was. A typical Israeli family, secular family, they have two kids and a dog. And I had two kids and a dog, 30 kids and a dog. And my dog noticed that his master is a little strange lately. And he decides that same Shabbos to follow me. And I didn't realize that he's following me. And there he's following me. He takes a position away from the shul watching when I come out. He figured I'll go in for 10, 15 minutes, probably finish and go out. And he sits there and he waits, and I don't go out. So he decides to check what his master is doing. So he walks into the shul on Shabbos. And here I'm in the front, I don't know what's going on. But all of a sudden, it's a big commotion in shul. Imagine on Shabbos, a dog walks into the shul and starts running between the aisles. And everybody's jumping and running in and out. You know, what's going on? It's a whole commotion. I don't know. I see things. What's going on in shul? I turn back and I see my dog. He says, what am I going to do now? And he runs with you. He's looking for me. And that's all I need now, besides everything, that a guy, a dog walks into shul. And he comes closer and closer. I make believe like I don't know him. And I even go with my leg, like when he comes close, like I had no relationship with him. But he didn't give up. And he jumped around me. And I was so embarrassed, I just walked out of there and ran away. It took me a long time to come back to that same shul. So that's part of what goes on. But all in all, Eva Karta Tov, you see what happened to your family, and you feel that business is business, but you make a little change, you change your priorities, and start doing a different type of business, which is what I'm doing now, Kiruv, and Baruch Hashem, I'm involved in an organization that has brought back many Jews worldwide, and is still doing so, and I so happen to be the CEO of the organization, and I thank Hashem for giving me the opportunity to take part in the Kuruv movement of Israel. And I wish you all atzloche, and hope that all you be able to make Karev Jews wherever they are, at any time and any opportunity that you have. Thank you very much.